welcome and thank you for getting up early and coming in this morning. As you know, our topic is in the area of commercial law or commercial litigation. Our presenters are Phil Corbett and Simon Rubenstein. Phil Corbett to start.
Thank you, Michael, and thank you all for coming so early this morning. Michael's asked Simon and I to try and sex these topics up. I'm afraid that you're all going to be sadly disappointed. They are perhaps a little dry, but we think they go together reasonably well. Shareholders on the one hand, directors on the others, on the other. I've prepared for you a paper, so Simon, which I don't propose to read from, but take it away together with your one CPD point. I assume it's only one, but if you can get two out of it, please do. Put the paper somewhere safe and refer to it again at another time if and when a shareholder comes in with some problem or a potential claim against a company. I thought I'd start this morning with a quote from a South Sea company prospectus, which I thought perhaps would start things off in terms of why and where shareholders' rights began. This was a quote from 1711. For a company for carrying on an undertaking of great advantage, but no one to know what it is. Now, that's a perfect prospectus quote, if you stop and think about it. It's not misleading. It's perfectly clear what risk the shareholder is undertaking. And believe it or not, this was a very popular company, and a number of shareholders invested in it and duly lost all of their money. The next quote has a twofold purpose, and it comes from Homer Simpson, and that is, weaseling out of things is important to learn. It's what separates us from the animals, except the weasels. And I say that's a twofold purpose. Firstly, because if Michael Green ever asks me to do this again in the near future, he'll understand why I don't take his calls. And secondly, it's about why directors need to be kept or brought to heel every now and then by shareholders, and why shareholders need to exert their rights, because people do try and weasel out of things. Directors try and weasel out of things, especially in the smaller private companies. So weaseling may be a bit of a theme, but the third purpose, I guess, of that quote was I just liked it and I thought it might get a small laugh. There's a number of members' rights, and I don't propose to deal with all of them this morning because time doesn't permit. But if I set them out here and go through them bit by bit, you'll appreciate the breadth of the topic. I should say that over the last 18 months or so, the number of shareholder actions and derivative action type claims that have been crossing my desk have started to dwindle. I don't know whether the same goes for the people in this room, but about 2 years ago there was quite a flurry of activity, especially in relation to oppression actions by shareholders. It seems now that things are quietening down with the GFC. Perhaps there's less money to go around. Perhaps people are sitting and waiting to see what they should do next. But like all these things, there's swings and roundabouts. Excuse me. I wouldn't be surprised if once the economy rises again, shareholders begin to flex their muscle and take on small company directors and indeed medium company directors. I've set out on this slide the various types of relief shareholders can pursue against companies. Firstly, there's the injunctive relief to prevent frauds on the minority or oppression. Secondly, there's the alteration or taking steps to insist that any alteration of class rights is properly done and in accordance with the statute. Thirdly, there is personal rights which they can enforce pursuant to their statutory contract. That was Sons of Gwalia case in the High Court is an example of that. Next, they can take derivative actions, and I'm going to focus a bit on that later in the paper, because that is a powerful right which shareholders have reasonably recently been given. Next, they can seek to wind up the company on a just and equitable ground. It's an area of relief which not often used, mainly because of the breadth of the oppression remedy and relief that you can seek for oppressive conduct. But just and equitable is quite good remedy for those people involved in smaller companies like partnerships, which are effectively family partnerships. And if there's a breakdown in communication, a breakdown in at board level between family members, just an equitable remedy is a very efficient way of dealing and winding up the family enterprise. Then there's the oppression remedies, and I don't want to cover that today because that's a topic in itself. And then there's also the right to, if you like, dob in the company directors for misfeasance to ASIC or indeed for an appointed liquidator if the company's wound up. As I said, I'm mainly dealing with small enterprises today. Professor Ford has observed, and I've set this out in the paper, that shareholders in the larger company, of course, in larger publicly listed companies, can exercise rights with their feet, sell their shares and move on. It's a perhaps slightly outdated view. I'm not sure that I necessarily agree with it, but I guess now disgruntled shareholders in the larger companies can, of course, go and tap on the shoulder of a litigation funder or indeed exercise rights with the class action provisions and group together and take on the company, especially larger companies, which we've seen a large number of those in the recent years. But by and large, the remedies I'm talking about today are applicable to the small corporations. The two areas I wanted to focus on was inspection, the power of inspection of the books of the company, and derivative actions. Firstly, the power to inspect, and that arises under section 247, capital letter A of the Corporations Act, and that allows a member of a company to, or of a managed investment scheme, to apply to the court for an order that they be entitled to inspect books of the company. Now, the definition of books under the corporations law is very wide. It includes any document, and I've set out the definition in the paper and you can look at it, but it's a very broad power which the court can exercise to let the shareholder into the doors or through the doors of the company to drill down and look at what the board has been doing and what in some cases executives have been doing in managing the company. And some of you will recall the fundamental principle that the court tries to apply, that it won't become involved in the internal management of a company and it won't try and second guess corporate decision making. But this is one of the exceptions, if you like, to that rule, where in a proper case, the court can order that the shareholder go in, inspect, and subsequently use information they've obtained to pursue other remedies. And it can be quite a powerful tool. I've had one client who was proposing a takeover of a company and used the power to effectively upset the board and cause board change by drilling down and finding documents which indicated that certain contracts entered into by the board preferred particular companies associated with directors, and that some of the provenance which had been given by the board about future profits were in fact, when one looked at the actual documents upon which they were based, misconceived or perhaps, put it politely, exaggerated. And what that then, once that material was out, it allowed the shareholder to topple a number of members of the board and move forward with a takeover bid. But the fundamental criteria for getting information through this power is that the applicant must be acting in good faith and that the inspection is for a proper purpose. And they're the two key tests which the court, or two key matters which the court must be satisfied about before making an order. I just, before I pass on to the next slide, you'll see from that slide that paragraph 2 says that a person authorised to inspect books make copies of the books unless the court orders otherwise, and similarly paragraph 6 is in exactly the same terms. That's not a typo, that's exactly what the Act says, and there's no explanation given for why the statutory provision appears twice. But it's there, I checked myself, and the actual Act that has been published says that. So that's one for the parliamentary draftsman to fix one day if they get around to it. General principles have been nicely summarised by Justice DeBell in South Australia in the case of Ace Hill Investments Proprietary Limited versus Incitec, and he summarised all of the cases and set out 9 propositions, which I'll just briefly go through. The first is that the test of good faith and proper purpose is a composite and objective test. So one looks at the material which is presented to the court and asks the question, what is the shareholder trying to do? Is it a legitimate, proper application made in good faith and for a proper purpose? The main way of resisting these type claims that corporations seem to take is to attack the good faith. They say, look, shareholder, you're not really after this information to achieve any proper purpose. You've got a collateral purpose, or you're not acting in good faith. You're really pursuing some private interest, not an interest in relation to or an interest which is in the interests of the company as a whole. That's the way to defend it. But as Justice DeBell has said here and in a number of other cases which I'll take you to and are referred to in the paper, all you need is really a proper dominant purpose, or a dominant purpose which is proper, and that will get you across the line. In point 2, His Honour observes that the onus is on the applicant to establish good faith. And in 3, the jurisdiction's likely to be enlivened if the shareholder is trying to protect some specific or personal right by the making of an order. For example, where a shareholder is contemplating oppression proceedings, or where they are trying to undermine a transaction which could adversely affect their investment, or where a shareholder seeks to ascertain facts for the purposes of a takeover offer. And then His Honour observes at point 4, if the applicant's primary or dominant purpose is a proper purpose, it's not to the point that an inspection may be of benefit to the applicant for some other purpose. So in other words, you can have a dual purpose, but as long as your dominant purpose is a proper one, then inspection will be granted. Paragraph 5 shows the tension between the indoor management rule and the right that's granted, but His Honour observes the rights provided by 247A should not be regarded as affecting the basic rule of company law that a shareholder should not ordinarily have recourse to the courts to challenge a managerial decision made by or with the approval of the directors. He goes on to say that it's no answer that an applicant may acquire information not available to others, and an applicant will not necessarily lack a proper purpose merely because they're hostile, or they will, after inspection, have more information than other members. Now, Point eight is a salient warning to applicants, and that is this isn't wide-ranging discovery. You need to be very specific about what it is you want to inspect and why. And generally, His Honour has observed, you won't get broad-ranging inspection to allow fishing, but things like board papers won't normally be available. However, he says that's not always the case. In paragraph 9, even where the applicant's acting bona fide and has shown a proper purpose, the court retains a discretion whether or not to order inspection. There's some other general principles that have been that can be extracted from the cases. I've set them out in the paper and in this slide. The last of the points is the most important one in terms of your own thinking about the subject, and that is it's relevant to ask when the court is looking at exercising the jurisdiction whether or not there's a case for investigation. If there's an element of the conduct of the board of directors or something which triggers to the court there is something that needs to be looked at here, then the jurisdiction's likely to be invoked. And then I give some examples of where the power and when the power might be used. For example, where the shareholder wants to look at whether or not reasonable grounds for making a profit forecast exists. That may lead to a subsequent action for misleading conduct. No doubt the board says, well, at the time we made the forecast, we had a reasonable basis for doing it, and this power would allow the shareholder to test whether or not that reasonable grounds exist before commencing an action. Or there's contracts with major suppliers which need to be reviewed, or the shareholder wants to look into whether or not relief should be pursued for oppressive conduct. And another example is the one I used earlier and Justice DeBell referred to, which was in takeover situations. It's also important to remember that the power to inspect is initially one which is granted to the applicant only. And if others sought to inspect the documents, you have to specifically seek the approval of the court. That's not to say the court won't grant it, and in most cases you'll see that accountants and legal advisers are given leave to inspect as well, but you do need to specifically seek that relief when applying. Similarly, if the shareholder is a corporate entity, then specific officers which you want to inspect the documents need to be identified and specifically named in the orders granting leave. There is also a provision that in the Act, I think it's section 248, that information obtained from inspection must remain confidential. In other words, like any compulsory process, there's an implied undertaking that you won't use the information for a collateral purpose. The procedure in seeking an order for inspection is very much like an injunction. You need an originating process in the corporation's form, an originating motion, and an affidavit in support. The affidavit needs to set out the bona fides, or the good faith element, and the purpose for which you want the documents, and also should set out, as I've said with precision, precisely what it is that you want to look at and also who it is that you want to inspect. That's the inspection of documents remedy. The next area I wanted to talk about in the time available is derivative actions. And this is the power of a shareholder or indeed a former officer of the company to commence a proceeding in the name of the company. For those of you that can recall your university days, you remember the rule in Foss and Harbottle that the proper plaintiff to remedy any wrong done to a company is the company itself. And there were, as you'll no doubt all recall, five or six exceptions to that rule, which you'd study back and forward, and the exceptions of when the court would allow a shareholder to stand in the shoes of the company and remedy its wrong or pursue its wrong or a wrong done against it. In 1998, a statutory provision was put into the Corporations Act, which gave members a right to apply to the court for leave to pursue the a remedy on behalf of the company. And that was seen to have clarified the rule in Foss and Harbottle and made it simpler, well, that was the intent, make it simpler for shareholders to pursue actions on behalf of companies where the company wouldn't do it itself. And the statutory derivative action provisions are set out in section 237 onwards of the Corporations Act, and effectively there's five conditions which must be satisfied. Firstly, that the company will probably not bring the action. So the classic case is where there's been a breach of director's duties by one of the directors of the board, and the board won't pursue that particular director for whatever reason. One can see the classic example of small family companies where mum or dad has sought to profit for themselves and won't pursue an action in the name of the company against the director to recover it, but there's someone else there, either a shareholder or an investor of some description or a former director, disgruntled director or officer who wants to bring an action for that recovery when the company won't do it itself. The second element is that the applicant is acting in good faith. Again, like inspection of documents, you must have a genuine purpose or a no collateral purpose in bringing the application. It must be in order to pursue a genuine right. The third point is that it's in the best interests of the company that leave be granted. Fourthly, that there be a serious question to be tried. Same sort of test as in injunctions, but the court needs to be satisfied that there is a genuine claim there that's arguable and not frivolous or vexatious. And then finally, notice of the application has been given to the company. Now, one and five go hand in hand. The easiest way to satisfy those two elements is to write to the company and say, we believe you have an action which you ought to pursue, and give them 7 days to respond. If not, then you bring your application. Dealing with the three main elements, that is good faith, interests of the company and serious question, the good faith element is again an objective test, and one of the questions the court asks is, does the applicant honestly believe that a good cause of action exists and has reasonable prospects of success? And that's something which the affidavit in support needs to address, and it may be supported by legal advice that there is a genuine case with reasonable prospects of success. Another way of setting it out is to, with the application, have prepared a form of pleading which sets out the cause of action which you wish to pursue, and more importantly, the nature of the remedy which you're seeking in terms of damages. If it's a substantial damages claim or equitable compensation claim or restitution claim, the court's more likely to stand up and say, yes, this is a good cause of action or one which genuinely exists which ought to be pursued on behalf of the company. The other question which the court asks is the applicant seeking to bring the action for a collateral purpose? If the shareholder is simply muckraking, trying to force a position out of the board in order to get them buy out of their shareholding, or if it's a disgruntled former director trying to pursue other remedies really on behalf of the company against the directors who dismissed him or her, then the court's less likely to give the requisite consent to pursue the action on behalf of the company. The next test is that the application must be, or the proposed proceeding must be, in the best interests of the company. Again, an objective test. Again, part of, if you like, the discretionary factors which the court needs to appraise itself of. And if the claim, as I said, is a small one, which the directors themselves don't want to pursue for some good reason, for example, they think it's unlikely that they'll recover from the proposed defendant, then the court's more likely to find that it's not in the best interests of the company to pursue that claim, because it's likely to run up costs and with a nil result. So one thing which you may need to satisfy the court is that the proposed defendant has the wherewithal to meet any judgment which you may obtain if the action's pursued. And then the other aspect is there a serious question to be tried? Like an injunction, it's a low threshold, but the court is trying to guard against frivolous and vexatious claims. If leave is granted to pursue the action, then leave is equally required, or leave must be obtained, to compromise or discontinue the action. The court has a power to give directions at the time of granting leave, and quite often one of the directions is that the parties go to mediation. The classic claims are, as I've said, against the current directors of the board for breach of duty, and this is one of the reasons that ties in nicely with Simon's topic. The court will often give a direction for mediation. If the proceeding is settled, you need to go back before the court and seek approval for the compromise. Generally, that'll be granted, but what the court's trying to protect against is some sweetheart deal between the director, between the applicant and the current board. So you will need to satisfy the court that the compromise is a proper one. Generally, and this is one of the problems with proceeding down this, or with this remedy, is that the costs of the action will normally have to be funded in the first instance by the applicant, not the company. If the application, if the proceeding is successful, then the successful shareholder, applicant, director, whoever has brought the action in the name of the company, would be entitled to indemnity for their costs out of the company. That was the traditional view and the view that existed in New South Wales. But in a recent case which I've set out in the paper, Justice Finkelstein, the last few weeks, has firmly stated that he doesn't think that that's the appropriate way of dealing with it. His view is that if the application is a proper one, if leave is granted in respect of a case which has reasonable prospects of success, then the shareholder ought not to be out of pocket, and the company should, at first instance, fund the proceeding. So there's been a bit of a change in heart there through Justice Finkelstein. So if you've got one of these applications pending, you might want to rush off to the federal court rather than the Supreme Court. Both of these remedies are very powerful tools in the hand of shareholders, as I've indicated. They are usually used in private companies to pursue claims for breach of statutory and fiduciary duty. The applications are both for inspection and leave to proceed are relatively discrete applications. As I've said, they're a bit like injunctions. They're easily determined by the court. The tests are, as I've set out, reasonably straightforward in their there's a great deal of case law on it, so that you're not really reinventing the wheel. And they can be used as in association with the other shareholders' remedies, which I've set out, both as an aid to the oppression proceedings and any other potential remedies which the shareholder may have, especially the power to inspect documents. So that's those two remedies. Finally, I thought I'd end with another quote from Homer Simpson move you forward as you're about to go and have some more breakfast, and that is, donuts, is there anything they can't do? So no relevance whatsoever, that quote, but I just saw that in the list of quotes when they came up. So are there any questions?
Yes. One of your examples, I think it was an example where you may get leave to spend. I think it says something about where the board, essentially doing business with, has entered into a contract with the supplier, which is an allowance thing. Which I wonder if that feeds into the next question of boards or companies doing business with members of the board. And is that coming out of any
particular
thing? I have a particular interest in this at the moment.
It does, and the case was before Justice Goldberg. It was that very issue of where there was a board that entered into a contract with an American supplier, who in turn had a contract with a board member's company, and it was a decision called Merrim. MERIM Proprietary Limited, where inspection was granted. Andrew Joseph, sitting over there, knows a little bit about it. That's exactly the type of case where, if you satisfy the court that there's, as I said, something worth investigating or a question to be investigated, that's when the jurisdiction's enlivened.
Yes.
Phil, if you've got a duty of confidentiality and you're given an implied undertaking for the material you get on an inspection, how do you then use that for a non-court application? You talked about where somebody made inquiries and used that to roll a couple of directors and make a takeover bid. How would you, for example, go to a meeting of the members and say, look, this prospectus was dodgy? How do you produce that to the meeting? The underlying material?
Well, you can't produce the material, but you can ask questions based upon it or ask for disclosure by the board. You're armed with the knowledge,
but
it is a difficult position to be in because you, in any circumstances where you've got the implied undertaking, for example, you get documents on subpoena, mm-hmm. or discovery in another proceeding, you're armed with the information, and all you can do is, armed with that information, use it without breaching the undertaking. And that's one of the limitations upon the power, but once you're armed with the information, you can go to the board and say, listen, I know what's going on here, what are you going to do about it? And if they don't do anything about it, you can then go to the court and say, they're not doing anything about it, I want to bring a derivative action, or I want them to, they're acting in a way which is oppressive or something, some sort of other relief that you want to pursue against them.
If you're giving this implied undertaking, does that mean that when you make the application, you really need to set out all the possibilities you think you might want to use the information for so that you've covered your field in that sense?
It certainly would help, yes. And then you can ask for permission from the court to use the information for that purpose, and the court does have the power to give those directions. So once you've got the information, if you want to be relieved, you could go off to the court. But it is, like the implied undertaking, there to protect the confidentiality of the information because it's provided by a compulsive process.
Would you issue in the federal or state court?
You can issue in either. I prefer the federal, but you know, the corporations list that the commercial court at the moment is pretty quick as well, and you know, you will get on pretty much as soon as you need to over there, and there's some very good people there now, and you know, another Michael Sifras and Peter Armand, they're all very competent people, and they seem to be eager for work at the moment, so it really doesn't make that much difference.
It's the last one I issued for inspection. I think the judge is likely to order a wind-up with liquidation, so...
It is. Once you go down that path, and if, as I said, there's something to be investigated as the test goes, the judges can often say, well, hang on a sec, this needs, you know, someone needs to take control here. And it's like an oppression proceeding. Often the ultimate end is a winding up. All right.